Case will be taken under advisement, and we move to the next case this morning, which is Thulin v. Shopko Stores.
Is there water?
You can take a minute to get your water.
Thank you. If it pleases the court, my name is Ross Bagelman, and I'm here today representing the appellant, Carl Thulin, and through the quicom provisions of the False Claims Act, the United States and the named states. The court below granted a motion to dismiss under 12b-6, where there was no dispute that the standard there is plausibility. And we're going to suggest today that the court below was wrong because he did not really consider the plausibility standard when it comes to the knowing standard and the falsity standard under which the case was dismissed.
You know, Mr. Bagelman, you focus on the provision that requires Medicaid recipients to assign all rights to payment from any third party. But doesn't that just assure that the right to those payments is transferred to Medicaid? In other words, what in that provision also requires that Medicaid can be charged no more than the third party provider would have been charged?
Well, the Federal Assignment Clause does not limit itself to the payment. It says in the Assignment Clause that any rights of the recipient is assigned to the government. And any right would include the right to have the drug for no more, as a third-party beneficiary, no more than the amount that was negotiated. So what I suggest is that the limitation, there is no limitation, I'm sorry, the limitation as quoted in the regulation by the government, the Assignment Clause is a statute, and the regulation that the defendant cites saying that the Assignment Clause is limited, as Your Honor just asked about, is not a regulation that would expand Medicaid's liability. It's a regulation that would limit Medicaid's liability. So that, for example, if you had a weak insurance policy, and that insurance policy said, you're going to pay the retail price of a drug, and we'll give you $50 towards it. In that situation, under the with the Assignment Clause, Medicaid would be entitled to the benefit of the $50, and the regulation says that Medicaid would pay no more than its scheduled amount. That's not the scenario that we've alleged with the Shopko case. What we've alleged with Shopko is that the third-party beneficiary of the agreement between Shopko and the insurance company indicates that the drug limit will be set at a certain price, and that the beneficiary, the Medicaid recipient, will only be charged a copay. So therefore, Medicaid, we suggest, under the Assignment Clause that assigns any and all rights, would only be responsible for that copay. It is a tortured argument, I suggest, to suggest that Medicaid, the purpose of the Assignment Clause and the purpose of that regulation was to say Medicaid will pay more. It's a program of last resort. It is the payer of last resort. And in this scenario, it would suggest that it waives third-party beneficiary rights that under the statute was part of the any rights that was assigned.
Has any court adopted your interpretation that the language assigning a right to payment includes the assigning of any rights to any terms of the contract that providers entered into with private insurance companies?
Well, the answer is yes and no, Your Honor. And I'll give you – I'm just trying to be forthright with the court. There is an opinion that I did not cite in my brief. That's a district court opinion from the same district that this court – this case comes from, the Western District of Wisconsin, and that is the SuperValue case. And in that case, there was a order granted, and just for the record, that would be 08CV578. And that is United States versus SuperValue. And in that case, the court limited its discussion to those states that have specifically said in their own regulations that it will limit itself to the copay. And those states that would apply in this case, that are mentioned in that case, would be Minnesota, California, and Michigan, I believe. That case actually mentions four or five or six other states that are where Shopko does not have stores. So the states that I mentioned, those states, and we cited in our brief the Minnesota regulations, specifically say, yes, Your Honor, it's limited to by the copay. But I think it was Judge Easterbrook in the Rogan decision out of this circuit that talked about the fact that just because a government administrator interprets a statute wrongly or does not seek to enforce its rights doesn't mean that it hasn't been defrauded by a party, by a defendant. The purpose of the False Claims Act is to protect the government, sometimes from itself or from
Counsel, will you? I have to admit that I'm having some problem. Give me an example of how Medicaid is harmed under your
I'd be glad to, Your Honor. This matter involves dual recipients, which means people that both have Medicaid and private
right.
insurance. And there's a whole group of people that fit under that category. And so there's a drug that is prescribed. They go to the pharmacy, and the elderly man or woman in the walker goes up to, most of these are Medicaid, they go up to the counter and they get a drug. And under normal circumstances, if they didn't have Medicaid, they'd say, okay, you have Illinois Blue Cross Blue Shield, and there's a $20 or $10 copay. And give us the $10, and that's you have the drug. You have a right to this drug as a third-party beneficiary.
That's with Medicaid, and they're...
But they also have Medicaid,
and Blue Cross Blue
which
Blue.
Is the payer of last resort. So if...
So the initial payer on that service, that's Blue Cross Blue Shield.
Yes.
And then the copay, then Medicaid picks it up, plus a copay.
Medicaid picks up, should just pick up just the copay. If Shopko would have told Medicaid the amount of the copay, but Shopko, which goes to my knowingly argument, Shopko deliberately designed two complex computer systems involving, I think it was 24 states, 280-some stores. I get the number wrong. I apologize. It's in the brief. And which deliberately did not include the copay information, including in the states that I mentioned. So Medicaid doesn't get the fact that there's a copay. Medicaid looks at the drug and says, okay, we would have paid $150 for that drug. Independence Blue Cross Blue Shield paid $100 for the drug. We'll pay the difference of $50. They'll pay up to their fee schedule. But the regulation, I suggest, since Medicaid is a program for the poor, paid for by taxpayers, did not mean to say we're going to have the taxpayers pay even more than private insurance companies.
So in your example, the
they pay $40 too much in my example. If it was a $10
too much. All right. In other words, Medicaid would be paying out that much, that difference.
Well, it's our suggestion, respect, that Medicaid got defrauded out of the $40 difference.
$40.
It could be $30 each. It depends on the amount of the copay. But what can't be disputed is that Shopko ignored industry standards, which is in their own material that was attached to their motion papers in the district court below. They ignored industry standards saying, oh, it's optional whether we give the government that information. So they made a decision not to provide it. But
it is optional, is it not?
No, it's not. Well, it's not. We suggest it's not optional.
It's not optional?
Well,
sounds like it would have to be optional in Minnesota, but I'm not sure. It looks like Idaho doesn't have the same rule as Minnesota does.
Well, that's correct. Idaho has not expressed the same rule. We suggest that these are federal claims. They're not only state claims. Medicaid pays, the federal government pays 50 to 60% of all these claims. These are federal claims. This is a federal statute.
But is there a federal rule? Or is this, a sort of a hybrid federalism here? Why all these states have their own rules? If there was a federal rule, why would the states bother?
Well, Judge, I don't know the politics of each individual state and the lobbying groups that states to enforce their rights.
But I'm here for the states.
I'm sorry, Judge.
The insurance is governed by the states.
The insurance is, but Medicaid is governed ultimately by the federal government. The states join the Medicaid program, they get approved plans, and they join it. But ultimately, these are federal claims. And in the SuperValu case, the government intervened.
Let's go back to the industry standard for a second. Even if there was an industry standard of supplying the information, how could the failure to fill an optional requirement be considered a knowing false claim?
I guess that gets back to my failure to answer your question about is it optional. So I'm glad you brought it back up to me, Judge.
Did you think you'd get away with that?
Well, Judge, I don't want to get away with that. Because I think that it's important. When I say optional, I don't mean the federal government has said it's optional. This industry trade group that has adopted this form that the government said is okay to present has the word optional under that section which just says copay. And copays don't always apply. They're not always copays. But the same document says that it should be provided, and it's the industry standard to provide it. So why does ShopGo decide not to provide it?
Well, yeah, but wait, because you're maintaining ShopGo is bound to submit the NCPDP, whatever. But the copay information certainly seems to be optional through that.
Well, Judge, it may be optional under certain circumstances, but in these circumstances, it's a material omission. And all you have to do is look at the Rogan decision, which has been adopted in the FERA amendments to the False Claims Act, dealing with the definition of materiality. And they made a decision to omit a material fact. Maybe in some cases, the number will be optional if it wasn't a material omission. But in these cases, it's a material omission. Medicaid pays substantially more just by ShopGo making its own decision not to tell the whole story.
Is there any advantage? I mean, why would you make something that has an impact on who gets what as far as the pot of money? Optional.
I have no idea, Judge. I don't know why they would do it. It's not done by the government. It's done by this trade group. And I guess because sometimes it may be irrelevant. Maybe in certain circumstances, Medicaid's paying a cheaper price than the drug that was negotiated. Medicaid is a payer of last resort. Maybe Medicaid gets the best. I'll give you an example. I just thought of. Medicaid is entitled to the best price on drugs. And I didn't come here today prepared to make a best price argument, though I've made them in the past. But is required to get the best price. Maybe some other insurance company negotiated even a better price. And Medicaid is only going to pay $90 on that drug that Illinois Blue Cross Blue Shield is paying $100. So maybe the $10 copay is irrelevant, and therefore it's optional to give it. But the key here is that ShopGo made that decision to ignore its own industry standards. ShopGo, a major player in retail pharmacy, at least in this part of the country, and made a decision to program a computer to not provide the copay, and as Your Honor pointed, even in Minnesota. And remember, we're here today dealing with the standard of plausibility. Shouldn't we be entitled to take discovery, find out why they made that decision, find out what circumstances copay would be optional, and which cases copay would not be optional? Remember, we're not here on summary judgment, pursuant like my predecessor arguments. We're here on a motion to dismiss.
I have two questions for you before you go away.
Sure.
One is, so your client comes out of Idaho. Do you have any facts other than Idaho facts that would be relevant here? And if you do, why isn't Judge Crabb's case already covered that? Because she's got Minnesota and all these other states. And Minnesota was the one you cited in your brief. But if Idaho has a different rule than Minnesota and your client's from Idaho and all his facts come from Idaho, how can he... If he were from Minnesota, I could see he'd have a stronger argument, but he's from Idaho. What facts are you going to put in?
Well, I want to thank you for that question because it's part of the argument that I should have got to and I wanted to, so I'll do it now. These are federal claims, and the law in this circuit, I believe in the King-Vassal case and in the Cruz case, which is, I believe, cited in my brief, indicates that that Medicaid are federal claims. And I'm not required, if I bring a False Claims Act case involving 27 states, to provide evidence in every single state. We've alleged at this stage of the pleadings, that there's a computer program, two of them, that are both designed the same way for all states, and that the Idaho example is therefore evidence of the other states. Otherwise, False Claims Act cases can't be brought. It's a rare day that a relator would have knowledge from every state in the union. And generally what happens is they bring evidence of a federal claim, and Idaho's claims are federal claims. And we've alleged that the system is used nationwide by SHOPCO, including states like Minnesota.
I hate to interrupt you, but these are federal claims, but each state sets their own rules, right?
That's correct, but I'm just answering each state, but it has to be in compliance with federal statute.
Well, go ahead and finish answering.
And Judge Crabb I've got the opinion right here from Judge Crabb, and she's covered a bunch of states here, and my understanding is this case ended in a settlement.
That's correct.
So the Minnesota folks, presumably by the federal government intervening, have been taken care of to the satisfaction of the federal government. And they settled the case, right?
Well, that's correct. My point of raising it is that, one, I was asked the question if there's any other courts that ruled on it. And my reason I was going to bring it up before the question was because in case we had the discussion about, well, this case was declined, wasn't it, which I'm used to hearing respectfully in courts, which is really an irrelevant question because the federal government's entitled to the full powers and tools it has to go against fraud, including the quitom provisions. And I want to raise it for the point that since it's the same point involved, they elected to intervene in that case. They can't intervene in every case. There are budgetary restraints and other governmental factors. And sometimes they allow people like me to go and argue the case for them. And that's what I'm here for today.
Can I ask one more question?
Sure.
Okay. So page 26 of your brief.
Yes.
You cited a CMS manual, and there's a provision 3904.7. In that, it said Medicare payments to providers who offer discounts to third-party payers. And so that's exactly this situation, right?
Yes.
This is what the manual says. Who made this manual, by the way?
I presume it was the Medicaid agency of
okay.
the state.
Whenever you are billed for the difference between the payment received from the third party based on such an agreement and the charges do not make Medicare payment. So that's the place where they're not saying when you're billed for the difference between the payment received from the third party based on the agreement and the charges, in other words, they've included more than just the copay. It doesn't say call the government and tell them to file a lawsuit. It says don't make the payment. Doesn't that suggest that that people do that kind of billing and that the regulators here place the onus on the government not to make the payment?
Well, I don't think it suggests that because if the government doesn't know about the copay, it presumes there's no copay and therefore does make a payment. And in fact, and I apologize because I don't have the page number, in our paperwork we talk about the fact that there's instructions from Medicaid to return the information and find out what the insurance
company paid. It's a true up at the end of the month then.
Right. And what happens here is they don't tell them the truth because there was a copay and what the third party beneficiary, the Medicaid recipient, and therefore the government is entitled to is the drug for no additional payment. It just would be beyond reason to say the government has a law that says we're going to pay more than we have to when it's a program paid by taxpayers to benefit the poorest among us. Thank you.
Counsel, I'll give you a few more minutes when you report a rebuttal.
Thank you very much.
And you add 3 minutes to Rafael. You've got 3 additional minutes.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the Court, my name is Tom Crane. I'm counsel for Shopko Stores. At the counsel table is Bretton Leon Quick, also with Minslevin. And in the audience is Peter Vanderhooten, who's Senior Vice President and General Counsel for Shopko Stores. The first procedural step after the complaint was filed was that career prosecutors from the Department of Justice and 8 Attorney General's offices reviewed the allegations in this case as well as a document submitted by Shopko. Each and every one of them decided not to intervene. I want to review just a few basic points why affirmance is warranted. Judge Connolly finds there are multiple basis for his decision to dismiss, and frankly, we don't think there's anything presented by Mr. Thulin's counsel that would warrant overturning that well-reasoned decision. Mr. Thulin premises virtually the entire falsity argument on the federal assignment provision, and Judge Connolly correctly found it was an untenable legal theory. There are two reasons to affirm on falsity. One, simply the plain meaning of the provision suggests no such meaning. If you will, Mr. Thulin's counsel seemed to want to expand on the first part of the plain language, which focused on any rights, and wants to read out the simple provision that talks about rights to payments from third parties. It's any rights to payments for third parties. There are a few ellipses to get to the end of the sentence, but that's what gets assigned.
If Mr. Thulin could establish that it was an industry standard to supply the copay data, would that have the force of law such that a knowing violation could be considered a false claim?
Your Honor, I'm just not aware of any case law that would suggest this, and I think I just briefly mentioned that was a document from the National Council of Prescription Drug, NCPDP, and in that back and forth, there was a question raised by one unnamed Medicaid agency, and the answer went on to talk about the industry confusion about this exact point. It didn't point to any particular standard. It was written in 2010 when they were talking about a new NCPDP system that was going to go into effect that would cure the confusion. So I just don't understand how that would form the basis of False Claims Act liability.
So, in other words, there's a dispute here as to whether there was an industry standard. Is that what you're saying?
I can't speak. There's nothing in the record to... there was confusion about how to submit the copay information when certain states required that information. That was discussed in that section. But that's altogether different, whether there's a requirement, as we know, Judge Kenney from Cruz, the statement must be a lie. The submission must be a lie. There's no requirement that Mr. Thulin has pointed to. Industry standard does not create a law. The second obvious reason to dismiss, to support the dismissal on falsity, is that the federal regulations and case law don't support it. I just want to briefly mention I was disappointed counsel raised super value for the first time. It's, of course, not in the briefs at all. If I could just briefly mention, though, well, I'm not prepared to discuss super value in detail. The Department of Justice intervened, and as Mr. Thulin's counsel pointed out, went on the theory of requirements of every single state. Department of Justice did not use the federal assignment theory in that case. You won't find it in that case. They went on a different theory. I want to turn briefly, if I could, to knowledge and why I believe the affirmance is also warranted there on knowledge. First, Judge Connolly, I think, you know, surmise, even if you had a dispute here, I don't think Judge Connolly was saying there was a dispute, a legitimate dispute on the federal assignment theory, but at best, if there's a dispute under Lammers, found that even if Thulin had presented an interpretation that was open to debate, as a matter of law, he cannot establish falsity under Lammers. I want to point out Mr. Thulin hasn't appealed the applicability of Lammers and the, Judge Connolly's holding in this part of the decision. But the judge also found a second ground to dismiss on knowledge, and that was not just Rules 9b. Judge Connolly found he had failed to plead even under Rule 8. I think that was a warranted decision, because Thulin's argument essentially is that if you have a claim and he's now said for the first time asking this court to adopt the federal assignment theory, that somehow, of course, Shopko Stores knows what's in their computer system, but that doesn't mean they're putting in their computer system information submitting to Medicaid programs that are in violation of law. That would be a false claim. Mr. Thulin only alleged they know what's in their computer system. We're not dismissing or arguing that. It's what legal obligation did they know of? Did they have knowledge of falsity that they violated? And I don't think he's pointed to anything, and Judge Conley properly dismissed that on Rule 8 and 9B grounds. Just very briefly, you know, Mr. Thulin, in his brief, also relied on Watson, your decision in Watson earlier in this year. I think there's several grounds that you really don't need to worry about Watson. First of all, Watson does not alter or in any way address the Lammers decision, which we think is proper. The district court's dismissal and knowledge, also in this case, did not turn on the meaning of the reckless disregard standard, which was the issue in Watson. In addition, Watson addressed the question of whether there was knowledge, whether a claim was submitted to Medicaid, not whether there was knowledge of falsity. And, of course, that's the issue in this case. I also want to point out, Judge Rovner, very properly earlier, you talked about if a matter, an issue isn't waived at the district court, isn't raised at district court, it's waived. Sorry to garble that a little bit. Mr. Thulin didn't raise the level of knowledge required for proof in the district court. Also, Watson came out in August, well before the district court ruled in this decision. If Mr. Thulin thought that Watson was controlling, he certainly could have briefed that decision. He chose not to brief that, and I think Watson is fully waived.
Counsel, let me get back. Your failure to allege fraudulent conduct is regard to the submission of claims by the individual pharmacies when they seek to reimbursement, right, or seek to be receive payment, not the fact that they knew it. I mean, that's your.
That's right.
They knew that they weren't getting that information.
Right. That's right. There was no requirement, as Judge Conley, for example, properly found in Idaho. There's no requirement at all to submit the copay information. By the way, I point out the Idaho rulings aren't being appealed in this decision. So the one facts Mr. Thulin does have, and he also points out in paragraph 42 of his complaint, he doesn't have access to the financial information in Shopko's computer system. So he has the Idaho claims that he saw, but those were ruled lawful. And I just don't understand how lawful claims in Idaho can form any basis to make allegations in other states, which on page 11 of Mr. Thulin's reply brief, he conceded that there's different state requirements. Well, they're different state requirements. They can change over time. And so lawful claims in Idaho, I just don't follow how that can be a proper pleading. And Judge Conley essentially found that. Regarding other states, Judge Conley dismissed on 9B grounds. He didn't, you know, just as a matter of judicial economy, didn't get into looking at the state requirements in other states. He didn't have to. These were not, you know, reasonable claims that could be used to argue illegality in another state with different requirements. I do want to just mention a little bit. We do think the plain meaning holds here. It's very simple. It's a condition of eligibility. The statute speaks to state plan requirements. It does not speak to providers. It does not speak to copay obligations. It does not speak to any sort of billing requirements. It's the right to assign the payment for medical care. That's all. He goes on expansively in his reply brief for the very first time to talk about third-party beneficiary law. With due respect, I think the court has ruled on numerous occasions a argument that's raised for the first time in a reply brief is raised. Judge Rovner, you've also pointed out if it's not raised below, it's waived. It certainly wasn't raised below. I don't know what third-party beneficiary obligations are here. It's a very complicated theory of law, what third-party beneficiary rights are, and to raise it for the first time in the reply brief, I just think are waived. In addition as well, he raises for the first time this stand-in-the-shoes argument, which, you know, for all the reasons I've raised before, you know, I think are waived. The plain language, I think, should be controlling. It's well understood that if the plain language, if the statute's plain language can be interpreted, which I think it clearly can here. It doesn't go beyond in any way in the manner he suggested. As I pointed out earlier, Mr. Thulin raised that super value somehow is applicable to the federal assignment theory. It just simply is not. It was not the position of the Department of Justice. Sorry, I don't remember super value that well. I know Judge Dow, you have it in front of you. I don't, but I don't think the court spoke in any way to the federal assignment provision. It may have said something about Minnesota law, but once again, out of judicial economy, the court ruled as far as other states on 9B grounds. You know, I think I've gone through the high points of the arguments. I'd be happy to take any other questions, but I really think this is straightforward. I think fundamentally, with due respect to Mr. Thulin, I think he's asking you to legislate new law and go in an area to apply the False Claims Act and all the implications of the meaning of filing fraudulent claims where the claim has to be a lie. To use the False Claims Act to legislate a new meaning of the federal assignment provision was enacted in 1977, amended a couple times. The federal regulations speak directly on point. We ask the court to affirm.
Thank you, counsel. You've got 2 minutes.
Respectfully to my adversary's argument that that industry standards does not create law. The only reason we brought up the industry standard argument is because the defendant in their brief attached that argument to their pleadings by saying that that's where they point to the word optional. In the same document, it says, I'm using the word however, I'm paraphrasing, however, industry standards are to provide this information. So respectfully, that's why it's provided. I was a little taken back by the arguments concerning government declination and a waiver, and I would like to address waiver shortly, but I just want to indicate that I did not discuss before King Vassal. And I believe that the reason King Vassal is controlling is because the judge below did not raise that. And I think he didn't raise it for the same reasons that we didn't raise it, and for the same reasons why it isn't waived. And that is, it took, I'm remembering correctly, over 2 years for the district court to rule after briefing of this motion. King Vassal came out in August of 2013. The ruling in this case, I believe, came out in September of 2013. And to be quite frank with the court, we didn't know about King Vassal until after the court had issued its order. I respectfully suggest that may have been the case with the district court, or how could they not have address the issue. And the court below used a different standard. And that standard was based on Lambert, which basically said, well, if there's no falsity, there's no knowledge, and there could be a dispute as to meanings of complicated regulations, we're at the pleading stage. We're dealing with plausibility. We're not dealing with complicated regulations. The plain language of the statute says any. And what we're requesting of this court is permission to go back and take discovery and support our plausible allegations. And we need not prove it. We need not say it's likely. All we need to do is say it's plausible. So I respectfully suggest it's a little disingenuous when my adversary says to this esteemed body that Watson came out well before, and we had an ample opportunity to brief it. We briefed it here today. We did not waive it because it didn't exist at the time we made argument in the court below. I will answer the obvious question as to why we didn't go to the court and say, well, here's Watson, because that's what you normally would do. Watson just came out. Please consider Watson. And the reason we didn't do it is for two reasons. And one, because the court took over 2 years to rule on the motion to begin with. And the second reason was that he basically made his ruling on falsity. And it was our opinion that even if he changes his opinion to the correct position that there's a reasonable, I'll call it the reasonable man standard, to be brief, it's not quite that, but the reasonable inquiry standard of Watson, he still would have denied our motion on falsity. And I think that when you look at falsity in terms of plausibility, I see my red lights on, in terms of plausibility, I think that we've made our case. The matter should be reversed and remanded back to the court to allow answering and discovery. Thank you all for your time and the additional time.
Thank you. Thanks to both counsel. The case will be taken under advisement.